Dragon Wing. Prologue. Be at ease, Haplow. Come in and make yourself comfortable. Sit down. There are no formalities between us. Allow me to fill your glass. We drink what was once called the Stirrup Cup, a salute to your long journey. You like the port? Ah, my talents are many and manifold, as you know. But I begin to think that only time, not magic, can produce a truly fine port. At least, that's what the old books teach. I have no doubt our ancestors were right about that, no matter how wrong they were in other things. There is something about the drink I miss, a warmth, a mellowness that comes with age. This port is too harsh, too aggressive. Fine qualities in men, Haplow, but not in wine. So you are prepared for your journey? Is there any need or want I can satisfy? Say so, and it's yours. Nothing? Ah, I do envy you. My thoughts will be with you every moment, waking and sleeping. Another salute to you, Haplow, my emissary to an unsuspecting world. And they must not suspect. I know we've been over this before, but I want to stress this again. The danger is great. If our ancient enemy catches even the slightest hint that we've escaped their prison, they will move land, sea, sun, and sky, as they did once, to thwart us. Sniff them out, Haplow. Sniff them out as that dog of yours sniffs out a rat, but never let them catch a whiff of you. Let me refill your glass. Another salute. This one to the Sartan. You hesitate to drink. Come, I insist. Your rage is your strength. Use it. It will give you energy. Therefore, to the Sartan. They made us what we are. How old are you, Haplow? You have no idea? I know. Time has no meaning in the labyrinth. Let me think. When I first saw you, you looked to be just over 25 years. A long life for those of the labyrinth. A long life, and one that had almost ended. How well I remember that time 5 years ago. I was about to re-enter the labyrinth when you emerged, bleeding, barely able to walk, dying, yet you looked up at me with an expression. I will never forget it. Triumph. You had escaped. You had beaten them. I saw that triumph in your eyes, in your exultant smile, and then you collapsed at my feet. It was that expression which drew me to you, dear boy. I felt the same when I escaped from that hell so long ago. I was the first one to make it through alive. Centuries ago, the Sartan thought to defeat our ambition by sundering the world that was ours by rights and throwing us into their prison. As you well know, the way out of the labyrinth is long and tortuous. It took centuries to solve the twisting puzzle of our land. The old books say the Sartan devised this punishment in hopes that our bounding ambition and our cruel and selfish natures would be softened by time and suffering. You must always remember their plan, Haplow. It will give you the strength you'll need to do what I ask of you. The Sartan had dared to assume that when we emerged into this world, we would be fit to take our places in any of the 4 realms we chose to enter. Something went wrong. Perhaps you'll discover what it was when you entered Death Gate. It seems from what I have been able to decipher in the old books that the Sartan were to have monitored the labyrinth and kept its magic in check. But either through malicious intent or for some other reason, they forsook their responsibility as caretakers of our prison. The prison gained a life of its own, a life that knew only one thing, survival. And so, the labyrinth, our prison, came to see us, its prisoners, as a threat. After the Sartan abandoned us, the labyrinth, driven by its fear and hatred of us, turned deadly. When at last I found my way out, I discovered the Nexus, this beautiful land the Sartan had established for our occupation. And I came across the books. Unable to read them at first, I worked and taught myself and soon learned their secrets. I read of the Sartan and their hopes for us, and I laughed aloud. The first and only time in my life I have ever laughed. You understand me, Haplow. There is no joy in the labyrinth. But I will laugh again when my plans are complete. For the 4 separate worlds, fire, water, stone, and sky, are again one. Then I will laugh long and loudly. Yes, it's time for you to leave. You've been patient with the ramblings of your lord. Another salute to you, Haplow. As I was the first to leave the labyrinth and enter the Nexus, so you shall be the first to enter Death Gate and walk the worlds beyond. The realm of the sky. Study it well, Haplo. Come to know the people. Search out their strengths and their weaknesses. Do what you can to cause chaos in the realm, but always be discreet. Keep your powers hidden. Above all, take no action that will draw the attention of the Sartan, for if they discover us before I am ready, we are lost. Death first before you betray us. I know you have the discipline and the courage to make that choice. But more important, Haplo, you have the skill and the wits to make such a choice unnecessary. This is why I've chosen you for this mission. You have one other task. Bring me someone from this realm who will serve as my disciple. Someone who will return to preach the word, my word, to the people. It can be someone of any race, elven, human, dwarven. Make certain that he or she is intelligent, ambitious, and pliable. In an ancient text, I came across a fitting analogy. You, Haplo, shall be the voice of one crying in the wilderness. And now a final salute. We will stand for this one. To Death Gate, prepare ye the way. Chapter 1. Wyrenne Prison, Dandrak, Mid-Realm. The crudely built cart lurched and bounced over the rough, coral-like terrain, its iron wheels hitting every bump and pit in what passed for a road. The cart was being pulled by a tear, its breath snorting puffs in the chill air. It took one man to lead the stubborn and unpredictable bird, while four more, stationed on either side of the vehicle, pushed and shoved the cart along. A small crowd, garnered from the outlying farms, had gathered in front of Wyrenne Prison, planning to escort the cart and its shameful burden to the city walls of Kellith. There, a much larger crowd awaited the cart's arrival. Dayside was ending. The glitter of the firmament began to fade as the lords of night slowly drew the shadow of their cloaks over the afternoon stars. Night's gloom was fitting for this procession. The country folk, for the most part, kept their distance from the cart. They did this not out of fear of the tear, although those huge birds had been known to suddenly turn and take a vicious snap at anyone approaching them from their blind side, but out of fear of the cart's occupant. The prisoner was bound around the wrists by taut leather thongs attached to the sides of the cart, and his feet were manacled with heavy chains. Several sharp-eyed bowmen marched beside the cart, their feathered shafts knocked and ready to be let loose straight at the felon's heart, if he so much as twitched the wrong way. But such precautions did not appear to offer the cart's followers much comfort. They kept their gaze, dark and watchful, fixed on the man inside as they trudged along behind at a respectful distance that markedly increased when the man turned his head. If they'd had a demon from Herica chained up in that cart, the local farmers could not have gazed on it with any greater fear or awe. The man's appearance alone was striking enough to arrest the eye and send a shiver over the skin. His age was indeterminate, for he was one of those men whom life has aged beyond cycles. His hair was black without a touch of gray. Sleeked back from a high, sloping forehead, it was worn braided at the nape of his neck. A jutting nose, like the beak of a hawk, thrust forward from between dark and overhanging brows. His beard was black and worn in two thin, short braids twisted beneath a strong chin. His black eyes, sunken into high cheekbones, almost disappeared in the shadows of the overhanging brows. Almost, but not quite, for no darkness in this world, it seemed, could quench the flame that smoldered in those depths. The prisoner was of medium height, his body bare to the waist, and marked all over with gashes and bruises, for he had fought like a devil to avoid his capture. Three of the sheriff's boldest men lay in their beds this day, and would probably lie there for a week, recovering. The man was lean and sinewy, his movements graceful and silent and swift. One might say, from looking at him, that here was a man born and bred to walk in the company of night. It amused the prisoner to see the peasants fall back when he glanced around at them. He took to looking behind him often, much to the discomfiture of the bowmen, who were constantly lifting their shafts, their fingers twitching nervously, their gazes darting for instructions at their leader, a solemn-faced young sheriff. Despite the chill of the fall evening, the sheriff was sweating profusely, and his face brightened visibly when the coralite walls of Kellith came in sight. Kellith was small in comparison with the other two cities on Dandrak Isle. Its ill-kept houses and shops barely covered a square menka. In the very center stood an ancient fortress whose tall towers were catching the last light of the sun. The keep was constructed of rare and precious blocks of granite. In this day, no one remembered how it was built or who had built it. Its past history had been obscured by the present, by the wars that had been fought for its possession. Guards pushed open the city gates and motioned the cart forward. Unfortunately, the tear took exception to a ragged cheer that greeted the cart's arrival in Calif and came to a dead stop. The recalcitrant bird was alternately threatened and coaxed by its handler until it began moving again, and the cart trundled through the opening in the wall onto a smooth, coralite street known grandiosely as King's Highway. No king in anyone's memory had ever set foot on the place. A large crowd was on hand to view the prisoner. The sheriff barked out an order in a cracked voice, and the bowmen closed ranks, pressing close around the cart, the front men in dire peril of being bitten by the nervous tear. Emboldened by their numbers, the people began to shout curses and raise their fists. The prisoner grinned boldly at them, seeming to consider them more amusing than threatening, until a jagged-edged rock sailed over the cart's sides and struck him in the forehead. The mocking smile vanished. Anger contorted the blood-streaked face. His fists clenched. The man made a convulsive leap at a group of ruffians who had discovered courage at the bottom of a wine jug. The leather thongs that held the man fastened to the cart stretched taut. The sides of the vehicle quivered and trembled. The chains on his feet jangled discordantly. The sheriff screeched, a young man's voice rising an octave in his fear, and the bowmen swiftly lifted their weapons, although there was some confusion over their target, the felon or those who had attacked him. The crudely made cart was strong, and the man inside, though he exerted all his energy, could neither break his bonds nor the wood that held them. His struggle ceased, and he stared through a mask of blood at the swaggering ruffian.
"You wouldn't dare do that if I were free."
"Oh, wouldn't I?"
the youth jeered, his cheeks flushed with drink.
"No, you wouldn't," replied the man coolly.
His black eyes fixed themselves upon the youth, and such was the enmity and dire threat in their coal-fire stare that the young man blenched and gulped. His friends, who were urging him on, though they themselves stayed well behind him, took offense at the felon's remarks and became more threatening. The prisoner turned, glaring at one side of the street, then the other. Another rock struck him in the arm, followed by rotting tomatoes and a stinking egg that missed the felon, but caught the sheriff squarely in the face. Having been prepared to kill the prisoner at the first opportunity, the bowmen now became his protectors, turning their arrows toward the crowd. But there were only 6 bowmen and about 100 in the mob, and things appeared likely to go ill for both prisoner and guards, when a beating of wings and high-pitched screams from overhead caused most of those in the crowd to take to their heels. 2 dragons, guided by helmed and armored riders, swooped in low over the heads of the mob, sending them ducking into doorways and dashing down alleys. A call from their leader, still wheeling high overhead, brought the dragon knights back into formation. He descended, and his knights followed him, the dragon's wingtips clearing the buildings on either side of the street by barely a hand's breadth. Wings tucked neatly at their flanks, their long tails lashing wickedly behind, the dragons alighted near the cart. The knight's captain, a paunchy middle-aged man with a fiery red beard, urged his dragon closer. The tear, terrified at the sight and smell of the dragons, was heaving and howling and going through all kinds of gyrations, causing its handler no end of grief.
"Keep that damn thing quiet," snarled the captain.
The tearmaster managed to catch hold of the head and fixed his beast with an unblinking stare. As long as he could maintain this steady gaze, the stupid tear, for whom out of sight was out of mind, would forget the presence of the dragons and calm down. Footnote. In the wild, these enormous birds are a dragon's favorite prey. Tear's wings are large and covered with soft feathers, and are almost completely useless. They can, however, run extremely fast on their powerful legs. They make excellent beasts of burden, and are extensively used as such in the realms of the humans. Elves consider the tear repulsive and unclean. End of footnote. Ignoring the stammering, babbling sheriff who was hanging onto the captain's saddle harness as a lost child hangs onto its newly found mother, the captain gazed sternly at the bloody, vegetable-stained prisoner.
"It seems I arrived in time to save your miserable life, Hugh the Hand."
"You did me no favor, Gareth," said the man grimly.
He raised his shackled hands.
"Free me. I'll fight all of you, and them too."
He flicked his head at the remnants of the mob peeking out of the shadows. The captain of the knights grunted,
"I'll bet you would. That death's a damn sight better than the one you're facing now, kissing the block. A damn sight better and a damn sight too good for you, Hugh the Hand. A knife in the back in the dark, that's what I'd give you, assassin scum."
The curl of the hand's upper lip was emphasized by a feathery black mustache and was clearly visible even in the failing light.
You know the manner of my business, Gareth.
I know only that you are a killer for hire, and that my liege lord met his end by your hand, retorted the knight gruffly. And I've saved your head merely to have the satisfaction of placing it with my own hands at the foot of my lord's bier. By the way, they call the executioner Three-Chop Nick. He's never yet managed to sever a head from a neck at the first blow.
Hugh gazed at the captain, then said quietly, For what it's worth, I didn't kill your lord.
Bah! The best master I ever served murdered for a few barrels.
Footnote. The barrel is the main standard of exchange in both elven and human lands. It is measured in the traditional barrel of water. An equivalent exchange for a barrel of water is one barrel. End of footnote.
How much did the elf pay you, Hugh? How many barrels will you take now to restore my lord's life to me?
Yanking on the reins, the captain, his eyes blinking back tears, turned the head of his dragon. He kicked the creature in the flanks, just behind the wings, and caused it to rise into the air, where it remained, hovering over the cart, its snake-like eyes daring any of those lurking in the shadows to cross its path. The dragon knights riding behind likewise took to the air. The tier master, his own eyes watering, blinked. The tier once more trod sullenly forward, and the cart clattered over the road. It was night when the cart and its dragon escort reached the fortress keep and the dwelling place of the Lord of Caliph. The lord himself lay in state in the center of the courtyard. Bundles of char crystal soaked in perfumed oil surrounded his body. His shield lay across his chest. One cold, stiff hand was clasped around his sword hilt. The other hand held a rose placed there by his weeping lady wife. She was not among those gathered around the body, but was within the keep, heavily sedated with poppy syrup. It was feared that she might hurl herself upon the flaming bier, and while such sacrificial immolation was customary on the island of Dandrak, in this case it could not be allowed. Lord Roger's wife, having just recently given birth to his only child and heir, the lord's favorite dragon stood nearby, proudly tossing its spiky mane. Standing beside it, tears rolling down his face, was the head stablemaster, a huge butcher's blade in his hand. It wasn't for the lord he wept. As the flames consumed its master's body, the dragon which the stablemaster had raised from an egg would be slaughtered, its spirit sent to serve its lord after death. All was prepared. Every hand held a flaming torch. Those milling about the courtyard awaited only one thing before they set fire to the bier, the head of the lord's murderer to be placed at his feet. Although the keep's defenses had not been activated, a cordon of knights had been drawn up to keep the curious out of the castle. The knights drew aside to allow the cart entry, then closed ranks as it trundled past. A cheer went up from those standing in the courtyard when the cart was sighted rumbling beneath the arched gateway. The knights escorting it dismounted, and their squires ran forward to lead the dragons to the stables. The lord's dragon shrieked a welcome, or perhaps a farewell, to its fellows. The tier was detached and led away. The tier master and the four men who had pushed the vehicle were taken to the kitchen, there to be fed and given a share of the lord's best brown ale. Sir Gareth, his sword loosened in its scabbard, his eyes noting every move the prisoner made, climbed into the cart. Drawing his side knife, he cut the leather thongs attached to the wooden slats.
We caught the elf lord, Hugh, Gareth said in an undertone as he worked. Caught him alive. He was on his dragon ship, sailing back to Tribus, when our dragons overtook him. We questioned him, and he confessed giving you the money before he died.
I've seen how you question people, said Hugh. One hand free, he flexed his arm to ease the stiffness. Gareth, loosing the other one, eyed him warily. The bastard would have confessed to being human if you'd asked him.
It was your accursed dagger we took from my lord's back. The one with the bone handle with those strange markings. I recognized it.
Damn right you did.
Both hands were free. Moving swiftly, suddenly, Hugh's strong hands closed over the chainmail armor that covered the knight's upper arms. The assassin's fingers bit deep, driving the rings of the chainmail painfully into the man's flesh.
And you know both how and why you saw it.
Gareth sucked in his breath. His side knife jerked forward. The blade was three-quarters the way to Hugh's ribcage, when, with an effort of will, the knight halted his reflexive lunge.
Get back, he snarled at several of his fellows, who, seeing their captain accosted, had drawn their swords and were preparing to come to his assistance.
Let go of me, Hugh.
Gareth spoke through gritted teeth. His skin was a ghastly leaden hue, sweat beaded on his upper lip.
Your trick didn't work. You won't meet an easy death at my hand.
Hugh, with a shrug and a slight sardonic smile, released his grip on the knight's arms. Gareth caught hold of the assassin's right hand, jerked it roughly behind his back, and, grabbing his left, bound the two together tightly with the remnants of the leather thongs.
"I paid you well," the knight muttered. "I owe you nothing."
"And what about her, your daughter, whose death I avenged?"
Spinning Hugh around by the shoulder, Gareth swung his mailed fist. The blow caught the assassin on the jaw and sent him crashing through the wooden slats of the cart. Sprawled on his back on the ground, the hand lay in the muck of the courtyard. Gareth jumped down from the cart. Straddling the prisoner, the knight stared down at him coldly.
"You'll die with your head on the block, you murdering bastard. Bring him,"
he ordered two of his men and kicked Hugh in the kidney with the toe of his boot. Gareth watched with satisfaction as the man writhed in pain. The knight added grimly,
"And gag his mouth."
Chapter 2. Kalith Keep, Dandrak, Mid-Realm.
"Here is the assassin, Magicka," said Gareth, gesturing to the bound and gagged prisoner.
"Did he give you any trouble?"
asked a well-formed man of perhaps 40 cycles, who gazed at Hugh with a sorrowful air, as though he found it impossible to believe that so much evil could reside in one human being.
"None that I couldn't handle, Magicka,"
said Gareth, subdued in the presence of the House Magus. The wizard nodded and, conscious of a vast audience, straightened to his full height and folded his hands ceremoniously over his brown velvet cassock. He was a land magus, and so wore the colors of the magic he favored. He did not, however, wear in addition the mantle of royal magus, a title he had, according to rumor, long coveted, but one which Lord Roger, for reasons of his own, refused to grant. Those standing in the muddy courtyard saw the prisoner being led before the person who was now, by default, the highest voice of authority in the fiefdom, and crowded around to hear. The light of their torches flared and danced in the cold evening breeze. The Lord's dragon, mistaking the tenseness and confusion for battle, trumpeted loudly, demanding to be unleashed upon the enemy. The stablemaster patted it soothingly. Soon it would be sent to fight an enemy that neither man nor even the long-lived dragon can finally avoid.
"Remove the gag from his mouth," ordered the wizard.
Gareth coughed, cleared his throat, and cast the hand a sidelong glance. Leaning near the wizard, the knight spoke in low tones.
"You will hear nothing but a string of lies. He'll say anything."
"I said remove it," remonstrated Magicka in a commanding tone that left no doubt in the minds of anyone standing in the courtyard who was now the master of Kalith Keep.
Gareth sullenly did as he was told, yanking the gag from Hugh's mouth with such force that he wrenched the man's head sideways and left an ugly weal on one side of his face.
"Every man, no matter how heinous his crime, has the right to confess his guilt and cleanse his soul."
"What is your name?" questioned the wizard crisply. The assassin, gazing over the wizard's head, did not answer. Gareth smote Hugh rebukingly.
"He is known as Hugh the Hand, Magicka."
"Surname?"
Hugh spit blood. The wizard frowned.
"Come, Hugh the Hand can't be your real name. Your voice, your manners. Surely you are a nobleman. The baton sinister, no doubt. Yet we must know the names of your ancestors in order to commend to them your unworthy spirit. You will not speak?"
Reaching out a hand, the wizard caught hold of Hugh's chin and jerked the man's face to the torchlight.
"The bone structure is strong, the nose aristocratic, the eyes exceedingly fine, although I seem to see something of the peasant in the deep lines in the face and the sensuality of the lips. But there is undoubtedly noble blood in your veins. A pity it runs black. Come, sir, reveal your true identity and confess to the murder of Lord Roger. Such confession will cleanse your soul."
The prisoner's swollen mouth widened in a grin. There was a flicker of flame deep in the sunken black eyes.
"Where my father is, his son will shortly follow," Hugh replied. "And you know better than any here that I did not murder your lord."
Gareth raised his fist, intending to punish the hand for his speech. A glimpse of the wizard's face caused him to hesitate. Magicka's brow cleared in an instant, his face smooth as a pail of fresh cream. The sharp eyes of the captain, however, had noted the ripple that passed across its surface at Hugh's accusation.
"Insolence," the wizard said coldly. "You are bold for a man facing a terrible death, but we will hear you cry out for mercy before long."
"You better silence me, and silence me quick,"
said Hugh, his tongue running across his cracked and bleeding lips. "Otherwise people might remember that you're now guardian of the new little lord, aren't you, Magicka? Which means you can run things around here until the kid's, what, 18? Or maybe longer than that if you can keep your web wound tight around him. And I've no doubt you'll be a great comfort to the grieving widow. What mantle will you wear tonight, the purple of royal Magus? And wasn't it strange, my dagger disappearing like that, as if by magic?" The wizard lifted his hands. "The ground quakes in fury at this man's blasphemy," he shouted. The courtyard began to shake and tremble. Granite towers swayed. People cried out in panic, huddling close together. Some fell to their knees, wailing and pressing their hands in the muck and mud, shouting in supplication to the Magus to ease his anger. Magicka glared down his long nose at the captain of the knights. A punch from Gareth, given somewhat reluctantly, it seemed, in the small of Hugh's back, caused the assassin to gasp and draw a painful breath. The hand's gaze, however, never wavered or faltered, but remained fixed on the wizard, who was pale with fury.
"I have been patient," said Magicka, breathing heavily, "but I will not be subjected to such filth. I apologize to you, Captain," the wizard continued, shouting to be heard above the rumbling of the ground and the cries of the people. "You were right. He will say anything to save his miserable life."
Gareth grunted, but did not reply. Magicka raised his hands placatingly, and gradually the ground ceased to shake. People drew deep breaths of relief and rose to their feet again. The knight's gaze, flicked aside at Hugh, met the hand's own intense, penetrating stare. Gareth frowned. His eyes went from the assassin to the wizard, and they were dark and thoughtful. Magicka, speaking to the crowd, did not notice.
"I am sorry, truly sorry, that this man must leave this life with such black spots upon his soul," said the wizard in grieved and pious tones. "Yet so he chooses. All here are witness that I have given him ample opportunity to confess."
There were sympathetic, respectful murmurs.
"Bring forth the block."
The murmurs changed in aspect, becoming loud and anticipatory. People shifted around to get a good view. Two burly warders, the strongest that could be found, emerged from a small doorway leading to the dungeon of the keep. Between them they carried a huge stone. Not the lacy and delicate coralite, of which almost everything in the city except the keep itself was constructed. Footnote. All the floating isles in the realm of Sky are composed of coralite. The excretion of a small, harmless, snake-shaped creature known as the coral grub. Coralite is sponge-like in appearance. When it hardens, it is as strong as granite, though it cannot be cut and polished. Coralite forms very fast. Structures made of the substance are not built so much as grown. Coral grubs give off a gas that is lighter than air. This keeps the isles suspended in the sky, but can be a nuisance when attempting to construct buildings. The magic of first house land wizards is necessary to remove it. Occasionally, deposits of iron and other minerals have been discovered embedded in the coralite. How they got there is not known, but it is presumed to have been a phenomenon that occurred during the sundering. End of footnote. Magicka, whose business it was to know the types and natures and powers of all rocks, recognized the stone as marble. It did not come from this island or from the larger neighboring continent of Eulandia, for no such rock existed there. The marble, therefore, came from the larger neighboring continent of Aristogon, which meant that this block had been dug out of the land of the enemy. Either it was a very old piece of marble and had been brought over legitimately during one of the few periods of peace between the humans and the elves of the Tribus Empire, a theory the wizard discounted, or Three Chop Nick, as he was known, had smuggled it over, which Magicka thought probable. Not that it mattered. There were numerous die-hard nationalists among the lord's friends, family, and followers, but the wizard doubted if there were any who would object to a piece of dung such as Hugh the Hand losing his head on an enemy rock. Still, they were a hot-headed clan, and the wizard was thankful that the marble was so covered with dried blood that few of Roger's kin would recognize the stone. None would think to question its origin. The marble block was about 4 feet by 4 feet and had a groove cut out of one side that was almost exactly the size of the average human neck. The warders, staggering under the weight, hauled the block out into the courtyard and placed it in front of Magicka. The executioner, Three Chop Nick, ducked out from beneath the doorway, and a tremor of excitement rippled through the crowd. Nick was a giant of a man, and not one soul on Dandrak knew who he really was or what he looked like. Whenever he performed an execution, he wore black robes and a black hood over his head, so that when passing among the populace on a daily basis, he would not be recognized and shunned. Unfortunately, the result of his clever disguise was that people began to suspect every man over 7 foot spans in height of being an executioner, and tended to avoid them all indiscriminately. When it came time to deal out justice, however, Nick was the most popular and sought-after executioner in Dandrak. Whether an incredible bungler or the most talented showman of his time, Three Chops certainly knew how to entertain an audience. No victim ever died swiftly, but lingered on in screaming agony as Nick hacked and chopped away with a sword that was as dull as his wits. All eyes went from the hooded Nick to the black-haired prisoner, who, it must be admitted, had impressed most of those present with his coolness. But all those in the courtyard that night had either admired or actually been fond of their murdered liege lord, and it was going to be a distinct pleasure for them to see his killer die horribly. The people noted with satisfaction, therefore, that at the sight of the executioner and the blood-stained weapon in his hand, Hugh's face set in mask-like calm, and though he carried himself well and forbore to tremble, they could see his breath come quick and hard. Gareth grabbed the hand by the arms, and dragging him out of the wizard's presence, led the prisoner the few steps to the block. "What you said about magicka," Gareth hissed the words in a low undertone, and perhaps feeling the wizard's eyes boring into his back, let the sentence stand unfinished, contenting himself with interrogating the assassin with a glance. Hugh returned his gaze, his eyes black hollows in the flickering torch-lit night. "Watch him," he said. Gareth nodded. His eyes were red-rimmed and bloodshot, his face unshaven. He had not slept since the death of his lord 2 nights previous. He wiped his hand across his sweat-rimed mouth. Then the hand went to his belt. Hugh caught a flash of fire reflecting off a sharp-edged blade. "I can't save you, Hugh," Gareth mumbled. "They'd cut us both to ribbons. But I can end it for you quick. It'll likely cost me my captaincy." The knight glanced back darkly at the wizard. "But then, after what I've heard, it's likely I've lost that anyhow. You're right. I owe that much to her." He shoved the hand around to stand in front of the block. The executioner solemnly removed his black robes. He disliked having them fouled with blood, and handed them to a young boy standing nearby. Highly elated, the child stuck out his tongue at an unfortunate friend who had been hovering near, hoping for the same honor. Grasping the sword, Nick took 2 or 3 practice swings to limber up his arms, and then indicated with a nod of his head that he was ready. Gareth forced Hugh to his knees before the block. The knight stepped back, but not far, only 2 or 3 paces. His fingers flexed nervously around the knife concealed in the folds of his cape. His excuse was framing itself in his mind. When the blade sank into his neck, Hugh screamed out that it was you, Magicka, who killed my lord. I heard it clearly. The words of a dying man are, they say, always true. Of course, I know that he lied, but I feared the peasants, being a superstitious lot, would take it ill. I thought it best to cut his miserable life short. Magicka wouldn't believe it. He'd know the truth. Ah, well, Gareth didn't have that much left to live for, anyway. The executioner grabbed hold of Hugh's hair, intending to position the prisoner's head on the block. But Magicka, perhaps sensing an uneasiness in the crowd that not even the excitement of a forthcoming execution could quite banish, raised a restraining hand. "Halt!" he cried. His robes swirling around him in the chill wind that had sprung up, the wizard walked toward the block. "You, the hand," said Magicka in a loud, stern voice. "I give you one more chance. Tell us, now that you are near the realm of death, have you anything to confess?" Hugh raised his head. Perhaps the fear of approaching oblivion had finally struck him. "Yes, I have something to confess." "I'm glad we understand each other," said Magicka gently. The smile of triumph on the thin, aesthetic face was not lost on the watchful Gareth. "What is it you have to regret in leaving this life, my son?" The hand's swollen mouth twisted. Straightening his shoulders, he looked at Magicka and said coolly, "That I never killed one of your kind, wizard." The crowd gasped in pleasurable horror. Three-chop Nick chuckled beneath his hood. The longer this death dragged out, the better the wizard would reward it. Magicka smiled with cool pity. "May your soul rot like your body," he said. Casting Nick a look that plainly invited the executioner to have a good time, the wizard stepped back well out of the way to keep the blood from spattering on his robes. The executioner drew forth a black handkerchief and started to bind it around Hugh's eyes. "No!" the assassin shouted harshly. "I want to carry that face with me." "Get on with it," foam flecked the wizard's lips. Nick grabbed his hair, but Hugh shook the hand free. Voluntarily, the prisoner laid his head down upon the bloodstained marble. His eyes were wide open, staring unblinkingly, accusingly at Magicka. The executioner reached down, took hold of the man's short braid, and yanked it over to one side. Three Chop liked a clear expanse of neck with which to work. Nick raised his blade. Hugh drew a breath, gritted his teeth, and kept his eyes focused on the wizard. Gareth, watching, saw Magicka blench, swallow, and dart hasty glances here and there as though seeking escape.
"The horror of this man's evil is too much," the wizard cried. "Be swift, I cannot bear it."
Gareth gripped his knife. Nick's arm muscles bulged, preparing for the downward stroke. Women covered their eyes and peeped out between their fingers. Men craned to see over each other's heads. Children were hastily lifted up to get a better view. And then there came from the gates the clash of arms. Chapter 3. Calith Keep, Dandrak, Mid-Realm. A gigantic shape, blacker than the Lords of Night, appeared above the keep's towers. No one could see clearly in the gloom, but the flapping of huge wings was audible. The gate guards clashed sword against shield, sounding the alarm, causing everyone in the courtyard to turn his attention from the impending execution to the threat above. Knights drew their swords and shouted for their mounts. Raids by tribus corsairs were commonplace, and one had been expected daily in retaliation for the abduction and subsequent death of the elf lord who had allegedly hired Hugh the Hand. "What is it?" bellowed Gareth, endeavoring vainly to see what was going on, torn between leaving his post at the side of the prisoner and rushing to the gates that were his responsibility.
"Ignore it! Get on with the execution!" snarled Magicka.
But Three Chop Nick demanded an attentive audience, and he had lost this one. Half of the crowd was staring at the gate, the other half was running toward it. Lowering his blade with an air of wounded pride, Nick waited in hurt and dignified silence to see what all the fuss was about.
"It's a real dragon, fools! One of ours, not an elf ship! It's one of ours!" Gareth shouted. "You two keep an eye on the prisoner!"
The captain raced to the gates to quell the spreading panic. The battle dragon swooped low over the castle. A score of rope cables glistening in the torchlight snaked through the air. Men leapt from the dragon's back, slid down the cables, and landed in the courtyard. Everyone could see the silver insignia of the King's Own glittering on their panoply, and the crowd muttered ominously. Swiftly the soldiers deployed, clearing a large area in the center of the courtyard, and placing themselves in position around it. Shields in their left hands, spears in their right, they stood at relaxed attention, facing outward, refusing to meet anyone's eyes or answer anyone's questions. A lone dragon rider appeared. Flying over the gate, the small, swift-flying dragon hovered over the circle cleared for it, wings holding it poised in the air, while it scanned the area in which it would land. By now, its rider's elegant livery, flashing red and golden in the flaring torchlight, could be easily recognized. The people caught their breath and glanced at each other with questioning eyes. The riding dragon settled to the ground, wings trembling, its flanks heaving. Flecks of saliva dripped from its fanged mouth. Jumping from the saddle, the rider cast a swift glance around the courtyard. He was clad in the short, gold-trimmed cape and red, flared coat of a king's courier, and the people waited in breathless anticipation to hear the news he had to impart. Almost everyone expected it to be a declaration of war against the elves of Tribus. Some of the knights were already looking about for their squires so that they might be ready to muster at a moment's notice. It was, therefore, with considerable shock that those standing in the courtyard saw the courier raise a hand gloved in the finest soft and supple leather and point at the block.
"Is that Hugh the Hand you are about to execute?" he shouted in a voice as soft and supple as his gloves.
The wizard strode across the courtyard and was admitted into the circle through the ranks of the King's Own.
"What if it is?" answered Magicka warily.
"If it is Hugh the Hand, I command you in the name of the King to deliver him to me, alive," said the courier.
The wizard glowered at the man darkly. Calith's knights looked questioningly in Magicka's direction, awaiting his orders. Until recently, the Volcarans had never known a king. In the world's very early days, Volcaran had been a penal colony established by the inhabitants of the main continent, Ualandia. The famous prison at Wyrenni held murderers and thieves. Exiles, whores, and various other social embarrassments were shipped off to the surrounding Isles of Providence, Pitrin's Exile, and the Three Jerns. Life was hard on these outer isles, and over the centuries the isles produced a hard people. Each isle was ruled by various clans. Each clan's lord spent his time either beating assaults off his own lands or attacking those of his neighbors on Ualandia. Thus divided, the humans were easy prey for the stronger, wealthier elven nation of Tribus. The elves gobbled the humans up piecemeal, and for almost 40 cycles the elves ruled both Eulandia and the Volcaran Isles. Their iron grip on the humans had come to an end 20 cycles earlier, when a chieftain of the strongest clan on Volcaran married the matriarch of the strongest clan on Eulandia. Rallying their people, Stephen of Pitrin's exile and Anne of Windsor formed an army that overthrew the elves and hurled them, some of them literally, off the isle. When Eulandia and Volcaran were free of occupation, Stephen and Anne proclaimed themselves king and queen, murdered their most dangerous rivals, and though it was rumored that they were now intriguing against each other, the two continued to be the most powerful and feared force in the realm. In the old days, Magicka would have simply ignored the command, carried out the execution, and done away with the courier if the man proved obstinate. Now, standing in the shadow cast by the pitch-black wings of the battle dragon, the wizard was reduced to quibbling. "You, the Hand, is the murderer of our lord, Roger of Caerleth, and it is the king's own law that we take his life in punishment."
"His Majesty fully approves and applauds your excellent and swift execution of justice within his kingdom," said the courier with a graceful bow, and he regrets that he must interfere, but there is a royal warrant out for the arrest of the man known as Hugh the Hand. He is wanted for questioning in regard to a conspiracy against the state, a matter which takes precedence over all local affairs. Everyone knows," added the courier, looking directly into Magicka's eyes, "that this assassin has had dealings with the elf lords of Tribus."
The wizard knew, of course, that Hugh hadn't had dealings with an elf lord on Tribus. The wizard also knew, at that instant, that the courier knew this as well. And if the courier knew this, then he might know a number of other things, such as how Roger of Caerleth had truly met his death. Caught in his own net, Magicka flopped and floundered. "Let me see the warrant," he demanded. Nothing, it seemed, would give the king's courier greater pleasure than producing the king's warrant for Magicka's viewing. Thrusting his hand into a leather pouch that hung from the dragon's saddle, the courier withdrew a scroll case. He removed the scroll inside and handed it to the wizard, who pretended to study it. The warrant would be in order. Stephen wasn't one to make a mistake like that. There was the name, Hugh the Hand, and it was sealed with the winged eye that was Stephen's device. Gnawing his lip until it was raw and bleeding, Magicka could do nothing but cast his people a much-suffering glance that said he had tried, but greater powers were at work here. Placing his hand over his heart, he bowed coldly in silent, ungracious acquiescence.
"His Majesty thanks you," said the courier, smiling. "You, Captain," he gestured.
Gareth, his face carefully expressionless, though he too had followed the unspoken as well as the spoken, came up to stand behind the wizard.
"Bring me the prisoner. Oh, and I'll need a fresh dragon for my return trip. King's business," he added.
Those two words, "king's business," could commandeer anything from a castle to a flagon of wine, a roast boar, to a regiment. Those who disobeyed did so at their extreme peril. Gareth looked at Magicka. The wizard literally shook with rage, but said nothing, merely gave a swift, short nod, and the knight left to obey the command. The courier deftly retrieved the parchment, re-rolled it, and slid it back into its scroll case. As he glanced about idly, awaiting Gareth's return with the prisoner, his gaze alighted on the bier. Instantly, his face assumed an expression of deep sorrow.
"Their Majesties extend their sympathy to Lady Roger. If they can be of service, her ladyship can be assured that she has only to call upon them."
"Her ladyship will be most grateful," said Magicka sourly.
The courier, smiling once again, began to slap his gloves impatiently against his thigh. Gareth was leading the prisoner past the king's own, but there was as yet no sign of a fresh mount.
"About that dragon..."
"Here, my lord, take this one,"
cried the old stable-master eagerly, offering the reins of the lord's dragon to the messenger.
"Are you certain?" queried the courier, glancing from the bier to the wizard.
He was, of course, familiar with the custom of sacrificing the dragon, no matter how valuable, in honor of the fallen. Magicka, with a furious snort, waved his hand.
"Why not? Carry my lord's murderer away on my lord's most prized dragon. King's business, after all."
"Yes, it is," said the courier. "King's business."
The king's own suddenly shifted their stance, turning their spears point outward and locking shields to form a circle of steel around the courier and those who stood near him.
"Perhaps there are some aspects of the king's business you would be interested in discussing with his majesty. Our gracious monarch will be happy to arrange for the governing of this province in your absence, Magicka."
The shadow of the wings of the circling battle dragon slid over the courtyard.
"No, no!" protested the wizard hastily. "King Stephen has no more loyal subject than myself.
You may assure him of that. The courier bowed and answered Magicka with a charming smile. The soldiers surrounding him remained attentive and on alert. Gareth, sweating beneath his leather helm, entered the circle of steel. The captain knew how close he'd come to being ordered to fight the king's own, and his stomach was still clenching. "Here's your man," Gareth said gruffly, shoving Hugh forward. The courier took in the prisoner with one swift glance that noted the lash marks on the back, the bruises and cuts on the face, the swollen lip. Hugh, his dark, sunken eyes seeming to have vanished completely in the shadows beneath his brows, regarded the courier with a detached curiosity that held no hope, only a sardonic expectation of further torment. "Cut loose his arms and unlock those manacles."
"But, my lord, he is dangerous."
"He cannot ride like that, and I have no time to waste. Do not worry," the courier waved a negligent hand. "Unless he can sprout wings, I do not think he will try to escape by leaping from the back of a flying dragon." Gareth drew his dagger and cut the bonds around Hugh's arms. The stablemaster, summoning his helpers with a cry, gingerly entered the ring of steel, removed the saddle from the courier's spent mount, and put it on the back of Lord Roger's dragon. Patting the dragon's neck, the stablemaster cheerfully passed the reins to the courier. The old man would not see the dragon again. Whatever came into King Stephen's hands never left. But it was far better to lose it than be forced to thrust a knife into the throat of a creature who loved and trusted him, than watch its life spill out, wasted on a man dead and gone. The courier mounted. Reaching down his hand, he held it out to Hugh. The assassin appeared for the first time to comprehend the fact that he was freed. His head was not on the block. That terrible sword was not about to sever his life. Moving stiffly and painfully, he stretched out his hand, caught hold of the courier's, and let the man pull him up on the dragon's back. "Bring him a cloak, he'll freeze," ordered the courier. Many capes were offered, and he selected one of thick fur and tossed it to Hugh. The prisoner wrapped the cloak around his shoulders, reached back, and gripped firmly the rim of the dragon's saddle. The courier spoke a word of command, and the dragon, with a trumpeting call, spread his wings and soared upward. The leader of the king's own gave an ear-piercing whistle. The battle dragon flew down until the ropes dangling from its back were within the soldiers' reach. Swiftly they climbed back up and took their places on the dragon's large flat back. The dragon lifted its wings, and within moments the shadow was lifted, the sky was empty, night's gray gloom returned. In the courtyard below, men glanced at each other in silence, their faces grim. Women, eyeing their husbands and sensing the tense atmosphere, hurriedly rounded up children, sharply reprimanding or slapping those who whined. Magicka, his face livid, stalked into the keep. Gareth waited until the wizard had departed, then ordered his men to set fire to the bier. The flames crackled as the men and women gathered around and began to sing their lord's soul to his ancestors. The captain of the knights sang a song for the lord he had loved and loyally served for 30 years. When he finished, he watched the leaping, roaring flames consume the body.
"So you never killed a wizard? You, my friend, you might yet get your chance. If I ever see you again, king's business,"
Gareth grunted.
"If you don't show up well, I'm an old man with nothing left to live for."
His eyes went to the wizard's quarters, where a robed silhouette could be seen looking out the window. Having his duties to attend to, the captain walked to the gate to make certain all was secure for the night. Forgotten, an artist bereft of his art, Three Chop Nick sat disconsolately upon the block. Chapter 4. Somewhere, Volcaran Isles, Mid-Realm. The courier kept his dragon under tight rein. Given its head, the small riding dragon could swiftly outfly the larger battle dragon. But the courier did not dare fly unescorted. Elven corsairs often lurked in the clouds, waiting to snap up lone human dragon riders, and so the going was slow. But at length, the tortures of Calith vanished behind them. The craggy peaks of Witherall soon obscured the smoke rising from the bier of the province's fallen lord. The courier kept his dragon flying near the tail of the Night Ray, the battle dragon. It was a sleek black wedge cutting through night's gray gloom. The king's own, strapped into their harnesses, were so many black lumps upon the Night Ray's back. The dragons flew over the small village of Hinox, visible only because its squat, square dwellings showed up plainly. Then they passed over Dandrak's shore and headed out into deep sky. The courier glanced up and down, this way and that, like a man who has not flown much before, an odd thing in a supposed king's messenger. He could see two of the three wayward isles, he thought. Hanastai and Bindistai showed up clearly. Even in deep sky, it was not truly dark as legend held night had been in the ancient world before the sundering. Elven astronomers wrote that there were three lords of night, and though the superstitious believed that these were giant men who conveniently spread their flowing cloaks over Arrhenius to give the people rest, the educated knew that the lords of night were really islands of coralite, floating far above them, moving in an orbit that took them every 12 hours between Arrhenius and the sun. Beneath these isles were the High Realm, purportedly where lived the Mysteriarchs, powerful human wizards who had traveled there in voluntary exile. Beneath the High Realm was the Firmament, or Day's Stars. No one knew precisely what the Firmament was. Many, and not just the superstitious, believed it to be a band of diamonds and other precious jewels floating in the sky. Thus, legends of the fabulous wealth of the Mysteriarchs, who had supposedly passed through the Firmament, evolved. There have been many attempts made by both elves and humans to fly up to the Firmament and discover its secrets, but those who tried it never returned. The air was said to be so cold it would freeze blood. Several times during the flight, the courier turned his head and glanced back at his companion, curious to note the reactions of a man who had been snatched from beneath the falling axe. The courier was doomed to disappointment if he thought he would see any sign of relief or elation or triumph. Grim, impassive, the assassin's face gave away nothing of the thoughts behind its mask. He was a face that could watch a man die as coolly as another might watch a man eat and drink. The face was, at the moment, turned away from the courier. Hugh was intently studying the route of their flight, a fact that the courier noticed with some uneasiness. Perhaps sensing his thoughts, Hugh raised his head and fixed his eyes upon the courier. The courier had gained nothing from his inspection of Hugh. Hugh, however, appeared to gain a great deal from the courier. The narrowed eyes seemed to peel back skin and carve away bone, and might have in a moment laid bare whatever secrets were kept within the courier's brain, had not the young man shifted his eyes to his dragon's spiky mane. The courier did not look back at Hugh again. It must have been coincidence, but when the courier noted Hugh's interest in their flying route, a blanket of fog immediately began to drift over and obscure the land. They were flying high and fast, and there was not much to see beneath the shadows cast by the lords of night. But coralite gives off a faint bluish light, causing stands of forests to show up black against the silvery radiance of the ground. Landmarks were easy to locate. Castles or fortresses made of coralite that have not been covered over with a paste of crushed granite gleam softly. Towns with their shining ribbons of coralite streets show up easily from the air. During the war, when marauding elven airships were in the skies, the people covered their streets with straw and rushes. But there was no war upon the Volcaran Isles now. The majority of humans who dwelt there thought fondly that this was due to their prowess in battle, the fear they had generated among the elf lords. The courier, considering this, shook his head in disgust at their ignorance. A few humans in the realm knew the truth, among them King Stephen and Queen Anne. The elves of Aristogon were ignoring Volcaran and Newellandia because they had much bigger problems to deal with at the moment, a rebellion among their own people. When that rebellion was firmly and ruthlessly crushed, the elves would turn their attention to the kingdom of the humans, the barbaric beasts who had stirred up this rebellion in the first place. Stephen knew that this time the elves would not be content with conquering and occupying. This time they would rid themselves of the human pollution in their world once and forever. Stephen was quietly and swiftly setting up his pieces on the great game board, preparing for the final bitter contest. The man sitting behind the courier didn't know it, but he was to be one of those pieces. When the fog appeared, the assassin, with an inward shrug, immediately gave up attempting to ascertain where they were going. Being a ship's captain himself, he had flown most of the air lanes throughout the isles and beyond. They had been taking a negative rid-eye, traveling in the general direction of Curanandistai, and then the fog had come and he could see nothing. Footnote. Rid-eye, navigational term used in the Tribus standard. The center for all navigation is the Imperial Palace in Tribus, from which, since early days when the races were at peace, all navigational readings are referenced. A negative rid-eye refers to moving closer to the current position of Tribus, while a positive rid-eye refers to heading in the opposite direction. End of footnote. Hugh knew the mist had not sprung up by chance, and had only confirmed what he had begun to suspect, that this young courier was no ordinary royal flunky. The hand relaxed and let the fog float through his mind. Speculating about the future did no good. Not likely to be much better than the present, the future could hardly be worse. Hugh had done all he could to prepare for it. He had his bone-handled, rune-marked dagger, slipped to him at the last moment by Gareth, tucked into his belt. Hunching his bare, lacerated shoulders deep into the thick fur cape, Hugh concentrated on nothing more urgent than keeping warm. He did, however, take a certain grim delight in noting that the courier seemed to find the fog a nuisance. It slowed their flight, and he was continually having to dip down into clear patches that would suddenly swirl up before them to see where they were. At one point it appeared that he had managed to get them lost. The courier held the dragon steady in the air, the creature fanning its wings to keep them hovering in the sky in response to the rider's command. Hugh could feel the courier's body tense, note the darting, shifting glances cast at various objects on the ground. It seemed, from muttered words spoken to himself, that they had flown too far in one direction. Altering course, the courier turned the dragon's head, and they were once again flying through the mist. The courier cast an irritated glance at Hugh, as much as to say that this was his fault. Early in his life, primarily for his own survival, Hugh had taught himself to be alert to all that happened around him. Now, in his 40th cycle, such precaution was instinctive, a sixth sense. He knew the instant there was a shift in the wind, a rise or dip in the temperature. Though he had no timekeeping device, he could tell within a minute or two how much time had elapsed from one given period to another. His hearing was sharp, his eyes sharper. He possessed an unerring sense of direction. There were few parts of the Volcaran Isles or the continent of Eulandia that he hadn't traveled. Adventures in his youth had taken him to distant and unpleasant parts of the larger world of Arianus. Not given to boasting, which was a waste of breath, only a man who cannot conquer his deficiencies feels the need to convince the world he has none, Hugh had always been confident in his own mind that set him down where you would, he could within a matter of moments tell where upon Arianus he stood. But when the dragon, at the courier's soft-spoken command, descended from the sky and landed upon solid ground, Hugh gazed around him and was forced to admit that for the first time in his life he was lost. He had never seen this place before. The king's messenger dismounted from the dragon. Removing a glowstone from the leather pouch, he held the stone in his open palm. Once exposed to the air, the magical jewel began to give off a radiant light. The glowstone gives off heat as well, and it is necessary to place it in a container. The courier walked unhesitatingly to a corner of a crumbling coralite wall surrounding their landing site. Leaning down, he deposited the glowstone in a crude iron lamp. Hugh saw no other objects in the barren courtyard. Either the lamp had been left in expectation of the courier's arrival, or he himself had placed it there before he departed. The hand suspected the latter, mainly because there was no sign of anyone else nearby. Even the night ray had been left behind. It was logical to assume, therefore, that the courier had started his journey from this place, and obviously expected to return, a fact that might or might not have much significance. Hugh slid down off the dragon's back. The courier lifted the iron lamp. Returning to the dragon, he stroked the proudly arched neck and murmured words of rest and comfort that caused the beast to settle itself down in the courtyard, tucking its wings beneath its body and curling its long tail round its feet. The head fell forward on the breast, the eyes closed, and the dragon breathed a contented sigh. Once asleep, a dragon is extremely difficult and even dangerous to wake, for sometimes during sleep the spells of submission and obedience which are cast over them can be accidentally broken, and you've got a confused, irate, and loudly vocal creature on your hands. An experienced dragon rider never allows his animal to sleep unless he knows there is a competent wizard nearby, another fact Hugh noted with interest. Coming close to him, the courier raised his lantern and stared quizzically into Hugh's face, inviting question or comment. The hand saw no need to waste his breath in asking questions he knew would not be answered, and so stared back at the courier in silence. The courier, nonplussed, started to say something, changed his mind, and softly exhaled the breath he had drawn in to speak. Abruptly, he turned on his heel with a gesture to the assassin to follow, and Hugh fell into step behind his guide. The courier led the way to a place that Hugh soon came to recognize from early and dark childhood memories as a Kyr monastery. It was ancient and had obviously been long abandoned. The flagstones of the courtyard were cracked and in many cases missing entirely. Coralite had grown over much of the standing outer structures that had been formed of the rare granite the Kyr favored over the more common coralite. A chill wind whistled through the abandoned dwellings, where no light shone and had probably not shone for centuries. Bare trees creaked and dry leaves crunched beneath Hugh's boots. Having been raised by the grim and dour order of Kyr monks, the Hand knew the location of every monastery on the Volcaran Isles. He could not remember hearing of any that had ever been abandoned, and the mystery of where he was and why he had been brought here deepened. The courier came to a baked clay door that stood at the bottom of a tall turret. He fit an iron key into the lock. The hand peered upward, but could not see a glimmer of light in any of the windows. The door swung open silently, an indication that someone was accustomed to coming here frequently, since the rusted hinges were well oiled. Gliding inside, the courier indicated with a wave of his hand that Hugh was to follow. When both were in the cold and drafty building, the courier locked the door, tucking the key inside the bosom of his tunic. "This way," he said. The direction was not necessary. There was only one possible way for them to go, and that was up. A spiral staircase led them round and round the interior of the turret. Hugh counted three levels, each marked by a clay door. All were locked, the hand noted, surreptitiously testing each as they ascended. On the fourth level, at another clay door, the iron key again made an appearance. A long, narrow corridor, darker than the Lords of Night, ran straight and true before them. The courier's booted footsteps rang on the stone. Hugh, accustomed by habit to treading silently in his soft-soled, supple leather boots, made no more noise than if he had been the man's shadow. They passed six doors by Hugh's count, three on his left and three on his right, before the courier raised a warning hand and they stopped at the seventh. Once again, the iron key was produced. It grated in the lock and the door slid open. "Enter," the courier said, standing to one side. Hugh did as he was told. He was not surprised to hear the door shut behind him. No sound of a key turning in the lock, however. The only light in the room came from the soft glow given off by the corralite outside, but that faint shimmer illuminated the room well enough for the hand's sharp eyes. He stood still a moment, closely inspecting his surroundings. He was, he discovered, not alone. The hand felt no fear. His fingers, beneath his cloak, were clasped around the hilt of his dagger, but that was only common sense in a situation like this. Hugh was a businessman, and he recognized the setting of a business discussion when he saw it. The other person in the room with him was adept at hiding. He was silent and kept himself concealed in the shadows. Hugh didn't see the person nor hear him, but he knew with every instinct that had kept him alive through 40 harsh and bitter cycles that there was someone else present. The hand sniffed the air.
"Are you an animal? Can you smell me?" queried the voice, a male voice, deep and resonant. "Is that how you knew I was in the room?"
"Yeah, an animal," said Hugh shortly.
"And what if I had attacked you?"
The figure moved over to stand by the window. He was outlined in Hugh's vision by the faint radiance of the corralite. The hand saw that his interrogator was a tall man clad in a cape whose hem he could hear dragging across the floor. The man's head and face were covered by chainmail, only the eyes visible. But the hand knew his suspicions had been correct. He knew to whom he was talking. Hugh drew forth his dagger. "A hand's breadth of steel in your heart, Your Majesty."
"I am wearing a mail vest," said Stephen, King of the Volcaran Isles and the Eulandia Cluster.
He was, seemingly, not surprised that Hugh recognized him. A corner of the assassin's thin lips twitched.
"The chain mail does not cover your armpit, Majesty. Lift your elbow."
Stepping forward, Hugh placed thin, long fingers in the gap between the body armor and that covering the arm.
"One thrust of my dagger there."
Hugh shrugged. Stephen did not flinch at the touch.
"I must mention that to my armorer."
Hugh shook his head.
"Do what you will, Majesty. If a man's determined to kill you, then you're dead. And if that's why you brought me here, I can only offer you this advice. Decide whether you want your corpse burned or buried." "This from an expert," said Stephen, and Hugh could hear the sneer if he could not see it on the man's helmed face.
"I assume your Majesty requires an expert since you've gone to all this trouble." The king turned to face the window. He had seen almost 50 cycles, but he was well-built and strong and able to withstand incredible hardships. Some whispered that he slept in his armor to keep his body hard. Certainly, considering his wife's reputed character, he might also welcome the protection.
"Yes, you are an expert. The best in the kingdom, I am told."
Stephen fell silent. The hand was adept at reading the words men speak with their bodies, not with their tongues, and though the king might have thought he was masking his turbulent inner emotions quite well, Hugh noted the fingers of the left hand close in upon themselves, heard the silvery clinking of the chainmail as a tremor shook the man's body. So it often was with men making up their minds to murder.
"You also have a peculiar conceit, Hugh the Hand,"
said Stephen, abruptly breaking his long pause.
"You advertise yourself as a hand of justice, of retribution. You kill those who allegedly have wronged others, those who are above the law, those whom, supposedly, my law cannot touch."
There was anger in the voice and a challenge. Stephen was obviously piqued, but Hugh knew that the warring clans of Volcaron and Yuolandia were currently being held together only by a mortar composed of fear and greed, and he did not figure it worth his while to argue the point with a king who undoubtedly knew it as well.
"Why do you do this?" Stephen persisted. "Is it some sort of attempt at honor?"
"Honor? Your Majesty talks like an elf lord.
Honor won't buy you a cheap meal at a bad inn in Thirpes." "Ah, the money.
The money. Any knife in the back killer can be had for the price of a plate of stew. That's fine for those who just want their man dead. But those who've been wronged, those who've suffered at the hands of another, they want the one who brought them grief to suffer himself. They want him to know, before he dies, who brought about his destruction. They want him to experience the pain and the terror of his victims. And for this satisfaction, they're willing to pay a high price."
"I am told the risks you take are quite extraordinary, that you even challenge your victim to fair combat."
"If the customer wants it."
"And is willing to pay."
Hugh shrugged. The statement was too obvious for comment. The conversation was pointless, meaningless. The Han knew his own reputation, his own worth. He didn't need to hear it recited back to him. But he was used to it. It was all part of business. Like any other customer, Stephen was trying to talk his way into committing this act. It amused the Han to note that a king in this situation behaved no differently from his humblest subject. Stephen had turned and was staring out the window, his gloved hand, fist clenched, resting on the ledge. Hugh waited patiently in silence.
"I don't understand. Why should those who hire you want to give a person who has wronged them the chance to fight for his life?"
"Because in this they're doubly revenged. For then it's not my hand that strikes the killer down, Your Majesty, but the hands of his ancestors who no longer protect him."
"Do you believe this?"
Stephen turned to face him. Hugh could see the moonlight flash on the chainmail covering the man's head and shoulders. Hugh raised an eyebrow. His hand moved to stroke the braided silky strands of beard that hung from his chin. The question had never before been asked of him and proved, so he supposed that kings were different from their subjects. At least this one was. The hand moved to the window to stand next to Stephen. The assassin's gaze was drawn to a small courtyard below them. Covered over with coralite, it glowed eerily in the darkness, and he could see by the soft blue light the figure of a man standing in the center. The man wore a black hood. He held in his hands a sharp-edged sword. At his feet stood a block of stone. Twisting the ends of his beard, Hugh smiled.
"The only things I believe in, Your Majesty, are my wits and my skill. So I'm to have no choice. I either accept this job or else. Is that it?" "You have a choice. When I have described the job to you, you may either take it or refuse to do so."
"At which point my head parts company from my shoulders."
"The man you see is the royal executioner. He is skilled in his work. Death will be quick, clean, far better than what you were facing."